This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening. Welcome to the fourth session of the Precision Medicine Osher Mini Medical School course. Tonight's topic is privacy, security, regulation, and voluntary data sharing. And this is a topic that I think many of you have been interested in since Keith's first lecture. We have three excellent speakers tonight, and it's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Claire Brindis. She is professor of pediatrics and health policy in the Department of Pediatrics and the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Health Sciences here at UCSF. She's also the director of the Philip R. Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies and the Bixby Center for Global Reproductive Health here at UCSF. Her research interests include intersections between population health and precision and personalized medicine, health disparities, consumer engagement and regulatory and health policy issues emerging from precision medicine, tracking the implementation of the Accountable Care Act, and strategies for closing the gap between the emergence of evidence-based innovation and its timely application to policy and programs. So I'll turn it over to Claire.
Thank you very much, Terry, and also thank you to all of you for coming tonight. We have a wonderful panel, and I will be your moderator, and also will be setting the table for the conversation for today. My colleagues on this panel include Dan Dohan and Mini Kahan, and I will be giving you a brief background on them as well. Dan is a sociologist by training and is a professor of health policy and social medicine at the Philip R. Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies. And he's also our associate director for training and development at the Institute. He's very interested in medicine as a cultural system. His research examines how medicine relates to science and discovery. And he's interested in how new medical technologies can reduce social inequality. Dan is also very interested in how do we train health professionals and how can we do a better job, particularly in facing the new realities that we're going to be talking about this evening. He's involved in a number of NIH-funded research studies in this area, and he will discuss tonight with you a project that he's helping to co-lead, which is called Engage UC, which is a UC-wide effort to improve how the University of California conducts biorepository research. And our last speaker is Mini Kahan, who's the Deputy Director and Chief Information Officer and a board member of our Clinical and Translational Sciences Institute, known briefly as CTSI. And what is the purpose of CTSI? CTSI helps to facilitate the rapid translation of research to improvements in patient and community health. It was established here at our campus in the year 2006, and the Institute was among the very first and largest of the now 60-member National Institute of Health-funded Clinical and Translational Sciences Awards. At CTSI, Mini is responsible for the Institute's programs and strategy, coordinating across UCSF and the national network. As CIO, she facilitates the development of technology and informatic projects that are necessary to accelerate research ranging from new ways to enable the discovery of expertise and facilitate networking to drive cross-institutional collaboration to better share clinical data for research across the UC medical centers. Her own training is as a neuroscientist, and she was trained here at UCSF, and so she is also a faculty member in the Department of Neurology. But she has also worked in Silicon Valley in the software industry and also in the philanthropic nonprofit sector. I can continue to introduce to you our esteemed panel members, but I think what I'd like to do is set the table for you in terms of thinking about these very complex issues dealing with privacy, security, regulation, and voluntary data sharing. And as I was preparing for this evening, I actually was thinking about my adopted grandfather, Daniel Rosenthal, who was a professor of materials engineering at UCLA. And I was an undergrad at UCLA in sociology, and we would get into these very long conversations about Daniel saying to me, you know, I have the hard sciences as a materials engineer. you in the behavioral sciences, you just have the soft sciences. And so finally, I one day remember saying to him, well, you know, Daniel, I think maybe we have a very different perspective, because quite honestly, if you go into any library in any university, you can have rows and rows of books that help you to understand physics and chemistry and many of the other sciences. I don't have that same kind of library to help understand human behavior. So I think I've got the hard sciences in relationship to you. So as we think about this very complex precision medicine and personalized medicine arena that we are operating in, I think we need to remember what do we mean really by the idea of personalizing medicine, and that is, how do we begin to couple the clinical and pathological data with the state-of-the-art molecular profiling, as well as really beginning to create a diagnostic, prognostic, and therapeutic strategy for our patients. And as a result of that coupling, then we can begin to tailor to each patient's requirements their particular kind of combination of drugs or therapeutics or other kind of disease treatment that we would like to do. I differentiate precision medicine from personalized medicine because I consider that you need precision medicine and all of the definition that I just shared with you in order to begin to help clients and patients think about the kind of data that they need in light of their own lifestyle, in light of their own family, in light of their own behavioral aspects of their considerations for disease, and to really think about how do we support clients, patients, and systems in doing a better job of enabling these patients to be making better decisions about their own health. So this is this intersection between precision medicine and personalized medicine where the many issues that we're going to talk about in terms of privacy begin to really have even more importance. As Keith shared with you at the very beginning of the conversations around precision medicine, we know that this is a combination of genetic, genomic, molecular, environmental. But as we begin to be thinking about all of these different layers, including the patient medical record, we need, I think, to go beyond these parameters to really be talking about ethics, to be talking about culture, to be talking about ethnicity and racial groupings, as well as lifestyle and behavior, because it's not that the genes are static. The genes are interacting with our environment at all times. So this picture really requires a much more complex picture of bringing all of these pieces together. And as you have seen this triangle before, we are really at a very interesting historical moment in terms of the confluence of factors that enable us to make some progress in this area. And that confluence that I look at is the increased ability to harness a tremendous amount of data, to have the advanced technology that enables us to do this kind of analytical work, mathematical, computational, as well as modeling, that allows us for the possibility of using big data to connect and analyze very disparate data elements from a very wide array of data resources or sources, which we need in order to identify those patterns of genetic disease treatment and outcome profiles. It really requires such a large number of records from thousands and thousands of people in order to detect those small genetic differences that may lead to our better understanding of what causes cancer, heart disease, and other diseases. However, if we don't begin to be thinking about simultaneously with those factors, issues of consumer engagement, privacy, security, data sharing, and regulatory, our concerns are that we're not going to fulfill the vision of what this kind of approach can really have the vision for it. So in many regards, tonight's conversation is very much about thinking beyond the box and thinking in a very multi-level arena. And that is the beauty of being able to bring transdisciplinary science, not only in the area of physics and chemistry and engineering and computational theory, as well as biomedical research, but also the tremendous need to bring the social and behavioral sciences to this conversation. We see that there's this biomedical continuum which builds a very seamless link between basic discovery, translational, clinical care, the role of patients, and the role of citizens. Because if we don't have an informed public like yourselves, there's no possibility that we're going to have the policymakers' attention about the importance of doing this kind of discovery. And we need all of our energy together to try to create a catalytic approach in terms of bringing the energy from various stakeholders. And as you'll hear from Dan and Minnie, there are many, many consumers that need to be brought into the conversation who in the past have been left out. And it's this leaving out that will create many more problems and many more issues in terms of our success. So clearly, there are many opportunities for big data to help us understand some of the complexities. But in bringing together big data from whether your claims data or cost data from medical billing systems or the clinical data from electronic medical record or life science data from genomics or patient and consumer data in terms of purchasing patterns and social media use and the new apps that are being developed. All of that requires a tremendous capacity for storing data, for analyzing data, but more importantly, different ways of using that data in many effective manners. So as I've just given you this very big vision about where we're going, the reality is that there's a lot of sand in the shoe. This is a sand in the shoe. So it doesn't matter necessarily the height of the mountain, but it's what's the complexity of these factors and how they interrelate with one another that could either facilitate and enhance our abilities or really detract from it. So I look at this symbol, and does anybody in the room know what the symbol represents? Exactly. This is the Chinese symbol for the word change. And in that language, the two components of it are danger and opportunity. So what I'd like to do now is talk a little bit about what are some of the challenges in terms of fulfilling the promise of precision medicine. For example, what system infrastructure will be necessary? What healthcare systems are going to be needed to be in place to provide this kind of precision and personalized medicine? And then along the continuum of health and illness, how could precision medicine be integrated? Can precision medicine be integrated even in the initial screenings in the idea for you to know very early on whether you're at risk for a particular illness? But that raises many questions about, do you want to know that data? How would we want to protect the privacy of that data so that you'd feel comfortable in order to be able to avail yourself of such potential testing? So I use this little cartoon to say, I think you should be more explicit here in step two, which is then a miracle happens. So I think we are on the verge of many miracles. And if you think about the fact that genomic mapping has only really occurred over the last decade, and we are very much at an embryonic stage of understanding of all the meanings of genomic mapping and what does it mean for our lives. What I'd like to do now is just go briefly over what I consider to be 9 challenges in the implementation of precision medicine, and my dear colleagues will give you more detail as we move along. So the first one really has to do with how do we derive the insights that we need from this very complex and large data sets that we're trying to pull together? What is our capacity to interpret this new knowledge? There's tremendous genetic variation, but as we're trying to figure out this genetic variation, there are so many variants, but trying to figure out which ones of these really account with something called translation with impact. So you don't want to go down the pathway of going to study a genetic variation that maybe not affects very many people necessarily. You really want to go and understand more, how is it impacting many large numbers of individuals in our society? We're also, in our second challenge, moving into a field or into an area where the costs related to genomic mapping is decreasing substantially. So now it's not unusual for you to be able to have the $1,000 genomic mapping, sequencing of your of yourself or a particular tumor to happen in as part of your clinical care. What is a challenge is what happens when the results come back from this genomic mapping, and what are the costs associated with the potential for perhaps having to do many more additional testing, many more additional kinds of healthcare, and we don't have enough knowledge yet about this relationship. A third challenge really has to do with where are we in terms of our technological advances, and are they outpacing our ability to use information effectively? A number of you who are perhaps affiliated with the University of California, San Francisco, know that many medical centers across the country are just really implementing the electronic healthcare record. Other systems, such as the VA, have had an electronic system in place for many, many more years, and they've been able to use it very successfully in terms of understanding the relationships, for example, of soldiers with trauma, post-traumatic syndrome, and its relationship to other morbidities. They've been able to bring large data sets together to be able to really interpret and understand what the correlations are between various disease entities, including things such as the relationship between HIV and other morbidities. A fourth challenge relates to, are we as a society ready to make these type of investments? Clearly, there is tremendous cost affiliated with these kinds of decisions that we have to make as a society. And it raises a number of questions about what other investments do we have to be making simultaneously, and who will be making those investments, and what kinds of disparities may continue to exist within this. Who will have available to them the kind of genetic testing? Who will have available to them the healthcare services that people will need if the genetic tests really demonstrate that there are more problems there that need additional treatment? A fifth area really has to do with regulatory issues. And again, Dan and Minnie will be sharing with you more information in this area, but I think it's important to recognize that regulatory issues cross across many, many different areas. They cross the FDA drug approval process. So, for example, you might have an FDA approval for a particular cancer drug for a particular test, but really at the same time, you'd like to have the flexibility to be able to test that drug with some other cancers that may also have commonalities with the underlying ways that that cancer is functioning. There's also issues around linking data from patient care with data from research and protections that have been established there. There's also a conflict between the need within precision medicine for very identifiable data versus a basic and translational research arena where de-identified or unidentifiable data is used. And clearly, there are regulatory issues around institutional review board requirements that are occurring across all medical centers and research centers where patient protection is extremely important. So there are a number of very good regulatory issues that are in place, but these regulatory issues could also interfere with some of the advances, and so we need to understand how do we create better systems. Another challenge, our sixth challenge, really deals with determining coverage and reimbursement. So, for example, right now, the molecular testing codes that are used across the country are some of the most important codes that are being used to receive reimbursement. And at the same time, there are a lot of questions about, does this molecular testing, do all of these processes help us to really have value for the insurance companies that may be paying for it, or the patients who may be paying for it out of pocket? And so there's issues about really determining what's the appropriate coverage and reimbursement. A seventh area really has to do with a very important area of patient confidentiality and consent. And we know that we have built in many systems around confidentiality for our patients, and Dan will share with you issues around consent as it relates to biobanking.
But we also need to recognize that we live in a society where we've had, not in the distant past, some very major lessons learned about the way that data was used in the life of Henrietta Lacks, where her data was not maintained private. And we understand the challenges around the fact that the cells that she provided, which became then the basis for a wide variety of activities and medical research, and yet she was never informed about the fact that her cells were being used in this way. And even today, it is a major resource for the type of research that takes place in terms of in biology. We need to recognize that the kinds of checks and balances that are needed when individuals provide this kind of donation of their cell, the ideas of their cells, they need to understand what are the ramifications of their sharing the data, and then we need to understand the stigma that's associated also with a number of these issues. For example, in terms of being able to use and provide cells, for example, cervical cells that were used from Henrietta Lacks. In the eighth area, I think that we move then into the system capacity. And here are a number of issues that fall, or at least in my mind, cluster under what is the need for more effective systems to deal with some of these issues, such as the need for maintaining confidentiality and protection of data. And as many of us are aware in the news, the tremendous controversy about the spying that's taking place right now, or the collection of data that's being conducted right now without our even knowing that this kind of data is being collected on us. There's also a tremendous need for standardization of risk assessment tools so that depending upon where you go for medical care, depending upon where you get your genetic testing, what kinds of risk assessments are occurring? Does every single village have their own assessment tool, or is there a potential for pooling the way that we gather information, which will eventually help us with some of this big data capacity for analyzing the information? Another system capacity is how do we begin to integrate more family history within the electronic medical record, and eventually our genetic data, if this data is gathered. And then also, how do we develop the capacity for solving many diagnostic dilemmas? That is, just because you have the test and just because you have the genetic result doesn't necessarily mean that your provider knows what to do with this data. It may be too early for us to know what to do with it, and it really requires a tremendous amount of knowledge about interpretation, what kind of counseling do you provide to patients, and also to really be thinking about what kinds of clinical decision support tools are necessary. And by clinical support tools, I'm referring to how do you begin to educate patients about the kinds of decisions that they will be facing when they take this particular or use this particular genetic test. Some more system capacity issues include the need to develop a policy agenda to support precision medicine, to be thinking about what's the literacy level, the health literacy level, and the genomic medicine literacy level of our patients and providers. And how do we educate the next generation of providers and healthcare workforce around some of the ability to be doing this kind of testing? And finally, and I'm sure that many more system capacity factors contribute or are on this list that I haven't listed yet, is really how do you engage patients and their families and the general public in this arena? And finally, the ninth area is the challenge of the intersection with population health. A major concern that we have is how do you begin to not just rely on using personal data or the health and social services data, but also community data. I mean, many of you are aware that depending upon your zip code will influence very much the kind of health profiles that you have. But how do you bring all of these together in a very meaningful sort of way? And then how do we begin to even use the data that we have today? As we understand the complexities of bringing together the new science, my pitch, and I guess my soapbox is the need to be really thinking about how do we use our current clinical data in more effective ways. And as I finish here, I want to say that we also have to be aware that even today, there are lots of things that our patients could be doing around health promotion. There's lots of things that our environments could be doing to improve the kinds of choices that are available to individuals. And yet, there's a lot of finger-pointing around, and for example, as exemplified in this cartoon. Isn't there anything more you can do, pointing to the doctor or the provider here? And then the doctor asking the patient, I was going to ask you the same. So we definitely have a lot of room for improvement, but we also need to recognize that there's a lot that we can do today with the information we have as the new genomic information is made available to us. And in terms of forecasting into the future, we know that prediction is always difficult, especially about the future. So I welcome you now to hear from Dan Dohan, who will share with you some of his experiences in terms of educating and engaging the public in some of these very challenging, ethically rich, and diverse topic areas. So, Dan?
Hi. Thank you very much, Claire, for setting the table. I think my job is to serve appetizers and get you to the main course, and then hand it over to Minnie, and then she'll do that, and then Claire will come back for dessert. So don't leave. But what I want to talk about is, Claire ended with this slide of the provider and the patient, and the two of them pointing fingers at each other. From my perspective in the research I've been doing, we're kind of in this together with you. And by us, I mean the people at UCSF, the folks who are trying to drive precision medicine. So I want to share some of my reflections as well as some of the research that we've been doing on what we need to do as a research institution, as an educational institution, as a public university to earn and to keep the public trust. Because actually, there's no way that we can make this work without the public trust. You guys have seen these numbers before. Precision medicine is going to rely on data from hundreds of thousands of people. It's going to involve thousands of scientists. It's very rich, dense, sensitive data. We can't get it from you. And again, we, the scientific community, can't get it from you without you knowing. We need to share it among ourselves. It's going to be hard to find any place to hide when we're engaged in this kind of work. It's definitely the era of big data, and you guys have heard a lot about that. And one of the sad things is that we're not the first people here. And by we, I mean the scientific, the research community. A lot of folks have gotten to the big data world before us, and most of them are interested in taking your money. So I shop on Amazon, and I help Jeff Bezos buy new cars or whatever new toys he wants. And I use Google because that's the only choice I have. And then Sergey Brin gets my data for whatever he needs it for. And my family back east counts on me to post on Facebook with all the latest pictures. And Mark Zuckerberg just finds that delightful. So I kind of feel like Lady Liberty here. I'm forced to participate in the big data world, but it makes me feel very nervous and very exposed. And as we think about our healthcare system and providing health, we'd like you not to feel this way. You feel exposed enough when you're seeing the doctor. It'd be nice if you didn't feel that way when we were doing research on the data that you provide us. So this, to me, is the challenge. How do we proceed to get your trust, to keep your trust, when really the precedent is that there's no good reason for you to trust us? So naturally, in that situation, the thing that most people consider is the eight most terrifying words in the English language, which is, we're from the government, we're here to help. And in this case, we've already seen that the government is not going to help. The National Security Agency has made these big data privacy issues seem even more destructive and sinister. And the federal government really has stepped back from engaging with the challenges that everyone recognizes are before them in front of privacy. Partly, I'm sure, this is because of their own challenges with NSA and security. But partly it has to do with just the complex politics of privacy regulation. And the federal government is really allowing the states to be innovative and take the lead. And California has been one of the states that's considered different regulation around privacy. And one of the regulations that we've been thinking a lot in my world has been some bills that have been introduced by a senator from Southern California, Alex Padilla, around genetic privacy. And this is not necessarily a bad idea to provide regulation that assures privacy, but the approach so far has been fairly blunt. And the approach that Padilla has suggested a couple times is really enough regulation that would make it impossible to do any sorts of research related to precision medicine. So the challenge, again, that we are thinking a lot about is that we don't we're not working in an environment where there's sort of positive role models to follow for how to take care of privacy and protect your data. We don't have a lot of help from our government to help provide guidance that would be useful. And in fact, we need to think about how to make sure that we can do our work, given that the regulation that is confronting us looks fairly stark. So this is sort of, from my perspective, a situation where it's really the onus falls on us to think about the fact that we need your data for precision medicine, that we need to earn your trust, and that we need to earn your trust not just today, but precision medicine is going to take a long time to create. We need to keep your trust over the long haul. So UCSF is actually pretty good at earning your trust, and I want to talk a little bit about the ways that we do earn it, and then change tone a little bit to talk about some of the research we've been doing to think about how we might be able to keep that trust going forward. So how do we earn your trust? A big way we earn your trust is by providing good care to you when you're patients within our healthcare system. Some of the folks that provide care do it by introducing new cures for cancer or by performing surgery on fetuses while they're still in the embryo, in the womb. We also do it through taking care of patients in a more community way, raising funds for disadvantaged patients or getting the word out to disadvantaged communities, communities of folks who don't speak English and maybe don't have as much access to health care as they need. So one way we earn your trust is through patient care. We do it through research by coming up with new devices and new drugs and discovering new facts about disease that help us cure disease. We also do it by helping you understand how healthcare gets used and the things that you should think about as a patient to be more proactive, to avoid getting X-rays or MRIs that you don't need, for example, and to be aware of the fact that overutilization of medicine is an issue. We do earn your trust through research on vulnerable populations, whether those are populations who are vulnerable because they're socially disadvantaged or because they're folks who are older and are just more subject to the medical care system and need to be more cautious. And we do this sort of in large groups and large teams that work together. And for me, this is a special part of UCSF and the UC system, this public mission. So ideally, through research, we earn your trust, and through patient care. And finally, we earn your trust through teaching. Teaching your kids, teaching your grandkids and the people you know, and allowing them to advance. So these are all terrific things that we do here at UCSF every day to earn your trust. But as I said, I think the real issue is how do we keep it, whether we're providing care or whether we're pushing discovery, acting as a school, acting as a public institution. And I'm very concerned about this as we think about precision medicine and wonder, are we just going to become like Facebook? Because I think Facebook has my data. They don't have my trust. And I think that they probably never will. And I think UCSF can't afford to adopt that same model. So how do we keep your trust? One basic thing, this is actually Claire is a wonderful director of my institute, and she threw an amazing party last spring to celebrate the institute's 40th anniversary. This was like a really big deal. It was in City Hall. I flew my mother out from Boston to join me. And in the midst of getting ready for this party, and I wore a tie and everything, I got a call from my friend Elizabeth, who is a friend but also a colleague, and she said, I just got a call from the communications office at UCSF, and Elizabeth is an associate vice chancellor. She's a very important person. So when there's a problem, people call her, and then she calls me, and she said, it turns out the Chronicle is going to publish a letter to the editor, an op-ed, in a couple days, and it's from a woman named Jenny Reardon. who is a social scientist. She's a professor at UC Santa Cruz. And Jenny had to go to UCSF for a medical procedure. And in the midst of getting this medical procedure, they put a form in front of her. And she, being a social scientist who does work on science and technology, actually read the form. And she read the form, and what it said basically was, you need this operation done, and we need you to check this box. If the implication was, if you don't check the box, you don't get the operation. And if you check the box, you're acknowledging that we're going to take your tissue and use it for our research. And she wrote, you know, this doesn't seem like such a great idea. So I think one thing that Jenny's editorial raised was, one thing we need to do is we need to communicate better. We need to be honest and transparent about what we're doing when we provide care and how we do our research. So Elizabeth and I, of course, the problem was we had to, the Chronicle had given us a chance to respond to this editorial. And we debated how should we respond. Well, it didn't seem like calling Jenny bad names was a good idea, because actually her point was absolutely and 100% reasonable. And in fact, we totally agreed with her. So we went back and forth, and what we eventually wrote was an editorial that said, UC advances medical research through trust. And we said, yeah, what she said is absolutely right. That is not the right way to do things. We agree it's not the right way to do things. And one of the problems is we don't actually know what the right way to do things is yet. We haven't quite figured it out. So communicate is obviously one piece of the puzzle, but we also said we also need to innovate. We need to figure out new ways of letting patients, of letting research participants know what they're getting into when they come to us for care or when they participate in our research studies. And we said, right now, we don't know the answer to that. So we want to figure out, in the research project that we've been working on now for about a year, is to understand what the public expects, what they want from a trustworthy institution in this new era of big data. The context that we're asking that question is in a research project called Engage UC, which Claire mentioned. And this is actually about biorepositories. Has anyone heard that term before? Very few people. That's what we found. Very few people have heard, know what a biorepository is. But it basically is when a tissue sample or a blood sample is stored to be used in research. And so it's kind of a simple concept that if you go in to get surgery done, oftentimes if you have a blood sample done, that will be stored. One reason it's stored is so that they can double check the work that the pathologist did and make sure that if they gave you a diagnosis of a cancer or gave you a diagnosis of non-cancer, that's true for quality assurance. But it also is extremely valuable to use those samples in research. And biorepositories have been used for many decades. Quite frankly, they've been poorly regulated and poorly overseen because there's been they're at that boundary between clinical care and research. And so our question was, how can we do a better job regulating biorepositories and doing this research better? For the purposes of this talk, whenever I say biobank or biorepository, you can think precision medicine, because a lot of the places where data for precision medicine will come from is from places like biobanks or biorepositories. Data will come from other places as well. But for purposes of thinking about trust, these things are pretty good substitutes for each other. So this is what Engage UC is. We're basically using the University of California as a laboratory for our social science experiment. The University of California has 5 medical centers. UCSF is one of them, but there also is one at Davis, in Los Angeles, Irvine, and in San Diego. And altogether, these medical centers see millions of patients every year and have an enormous amount of research going on, almost $2 billion just from the NIH alone. So tremendous amounts of research, lots of patients, lots of people coming through. This is an NIH-funded project. That's what this is a snapshot of our award letter. If you're a UCSF researcher and you get an award letter from the NIH, you usually frame it and put it on your wall because those are pretty cool. And what we're trying to do in this very wordy thing at the bottom is come up with an ethical, efficient, and a sustainable approach for obtaining, processing, and sharing biospecimens and data in the UC system. And I would say that that is a very fancy way of saying we're trying to figure out how to make biobanks work better so that they maintain your trust and that they can keep doing the important work that they do in supporting research by UC researchers. So that's what Engage UC is hoping to do. And one of the main things that we're doing, and the first thing that we've done, is to talk to people in the public about what they think about biobanking research. So we have a whole group of people who've been working to engage the public and understand what they think about biobanking. And like most of the people in this room, when we first ask people about biobanking, they don't know a thing because they've never heard of it before. So the first question we had was, well, we want to know what people think about biobanking and what we'd have to do it in a trustworthy way, and how can we find out the answer to those questions? So we could ask them in a survey, or we could get them together for focus groups. We could ask advocates, that is people who are already thinking about this issue. And we thought about it and decided none of those things actually made any sense. And the reason that we didn't want to do any of those things is that biobanks and big data are really specialized areas that are not well understood by the general public. And we wanted to know about the general public, the people who use Facebook and the people who use Google, that group of people, which is everybody. So instead of doing any of these things, we did something quite different. We used a technique called deliberative democracy. And we wanted to find out how UC can earn and keep your trust in the opinion of ordinary Californians. So this is the steps that we undertook. And what I'm going to then spend the rest of the time doing is telling you what we found out. And hopefully that will be of some interest and use as you think about the issues that Minnie's then going to be talking about next. So when I say ordinary Californians, I mean really ordinary Californians. We recruited 52 people at random, 26 in L.A. and 26 up here in San Francisco. And because we knew that none of these people knew anything about biobanking, we developed a whole series of materials to help educate them. A briefing book, which is about a 40-page booklet that describes with pictures and in very ordinary, concrete language what a biobank is and what things you should be worried about if you are have your tissue in a biobank. We also then had experts come and talk to people when we gathered them and when we had them talk about these issues among themselves. And we did that through four full days, two weekends, Saturday and Sunday, and then we gave them a weekend off, and then the next Saturday and Sunday after that for long periods of time, 9 to 5 on each day. We paid them so that there was some, you know, there was some reasonable compensation for them. We had the whole group, all 26 people in each place, talk among themselves. We also did small breakout groups so they could talk to each other in smaller groups about the issues that they were thinking about. And what we asked them to do by the end of the second weekend, after 4 days of debate, was to come up with some recommendations, to tell us really what they wanted us to do. We asked them to figure out what were the things that they agreed about, what were the things that they didn't agree about and they were never going to agree about, persistent disagreements, and then also, what are the things you want us to think about and you see that you want us to do if you want us to do this work in a way that you would trust us to keep doing it going forward? So those are the three things that I'm going to now talk about, what they agreed about, what they disagreed about, and what they want us to do. So here's the first thing that they agreed about, and actually this came as somewhat of a surprise to me. These are the LA deliberants. It's not every single one of them because some didn't want to have their picture taken, but it's almost all of them. And we noticed, I'll show you the San here. I'll show you the San Francisco folks. They're very colorful. The folks in LA are much more colorful than we are in San Francisco. That's one of the conclusions that I've drawn. The deliberants all agreed that we should do this research. And I actually was a little bit surprised by that. I thought that might have been a little bit controversial. And some folks might have said, you know what? I don't really see why you need to do this. And isn't there some other way to carry out this research? But in both groups, broad agreement that UC should be in the biobank research business. Second, and this is the San Francisco group, who you notice is dressed less colorfully, they really enjoyed the process of learning about biobanking. They really appreciated the materials we provided, the lectures, and they thought that everyone should know about biobanking. They wanted us to buy airtime on televisions and get the word out there that biobanks are out there and they're really cool and they're doing good stuff. So they really encouraged us and agreed that there needed to be more public education and outreach about biobanks, and that that had to happen through television and radio, mass media, you know, multimedia, all kinds of innovative ways, not just by putting up posters around the UC campuses. One of the other things, and I mentioned this previously, that historically biobanks have been poorly regulated and these samples have sort of gone sneakily into biobanks without really a true acknowledgement of what's happening. That's what Jenny Reardon was writing about. And the deliberants all told us that from this point forward, they would like to see us do a much better and much more careful job of getting informed consent when they're contributing a sample to a biobank. They want that consent to be clearly communicated. They want it to be in language that's easy to understand in multiple languages, because there's lots of languages spoken in California. They wanted it done in a multimedia format, and probably also with someone there to answer questions. And most especially, they wanted this done not when someone's being wheeled into the operating theater, but well in advance of when the donation was going to be made and when the person is not feeling stressed. Some people even said, you should ask multiple times. Ask a week before, ask during the procedure, ask right after, ask 2 weeks after, and then check again 3 months after that. So this notion of really making sure that people understand what they're being asked to do was a very important area of agreement. And those are the big things that they all agreed upon, that it was a good thing to do, that there should be broader knowledge of it, and that consent should be done much more carefully and thoughtfully. Then there were some areas of disagreement. One big issue was, what do we do with the fact that we've collected hundreds of thousands of samples and we haven't collected them in the right way, but they're still there? They're in freezers all over UCSF and all over the other campuses. In fact, no one even knows how many biobanks there are at UCSF, and no one has any idea how many biobanks there are within the UC system, and no one has the foggiest clue how many biobanks there are in the entire world. It's just it's a complete unknown at this point. But the issue is, what do we do with all of this important information and data and samples that have been collected? Most people that we spoke with said you should hold on to it and use it for legitimate research. But some felt very strongly that these samples should be discarded, that they weren't collected properly, that either the donors or the family members of the donors didn't know these samples were there, and that they should be discarded. So that was an area of persistent disagreement. They couldn't agree. Some people said fine. Most people said fine, but some people said this is quite problematic. Another issue that arises is, once you donate a sample to a biobank, you don't know how it's going to be used in research. The research is constantly changing. Precision medicine is a perfect example of this. We have no idea what precision medicine is going to be doing in 10 years, but it's almost certainly not something we can't think up today. So what do you do about the fact that you're going to donate a sample and we don't know how it will be used? Some people said, you know, when that happens, we really should keep a list of everyone who has donated to the biobank and let them know if something radical or new comes up so that they understand how their sample is being used. Others felt like that was not a big deal. As long as you knew today that you were donating your sample, how it was used for future research was not that important. So this was another area of persistent disagreement. A final issue, and Claire alluded to this, is oftentimes we discover things that we don't quite understand the significance of. So we know you'll have some sort of gene mutation, but we don't know what it means. And one of the real big questions for biobank research and in precision medicine is, what do we do with those results that we don't quite understand what they are? Some of the deliberants felt like you should let people know when you found something, even if you don't exactly know what it means. And other deliberants said, you know what? If I don't know it, that's fine. Don't tell me stuff that you don't understand what it is. I prefer to live, you know, and be ignorant of that and not have to worry about this uncertainty. So an area of persistent disagreement here, this is called return of research results, where some people felt we should give everything back and others felt that wasn't such a good idea. And these pictures, by the way, are of discussions in our small groups and just sort of discussions that happened throughout the event. So finally, here are a couple of recommendations. A big way that precision medicine operates is by operating at a large scale, by sharing data across thousands of researchers. Biobanks are the same way. A good biobank is a biobank where lots of people have access to the samples and the data, and it's shared widely. Our deliberants wanted us to share data widely, especially within a university, within the University of California, but they were very concerned about sharing it once the data or samples left the U.S., and I think the feeling there was, without U.S. laws governing the use of that data and samples, who can say what could happen? So be cautious about sharing overseas, and really, particularly in the L.A. group, but in both groups, a real concern about what our government might do with this data. And, you know, mistrust of government is part of our American way of life, so that's not entirely surprising. So the recommendation was to share the data widely for medical research, but beware of sharing overseas and beware of sharing with the federal government. finally, and I think from our perspective, perhaps one of the most important recommendations was establish robust governance of UC biobanks that includes public input. So this is what we're working on now. Our next step is to figure out how do we get the public involved in helping us regulate and inform the policies around biobanks. And again, I think it's a fair thing to say that this is also something that these deliberants would probably say is true for precision medicine as well. That there needs to be some sort of robust way of making sure that people understand what we're doing and that they can provide input into it in a meaningful way that's actionable and taken seriously by researchers. So I'm going to leave that things here, that we are really thinking a lot about precision medicine and the public trust. I think this is an incredibly important place for UCSF to invest in it, and I'm happy to say that I think it is a place where UCSF is investing so that we can understand what the public expects from their trustworthy institutions, so that we can continue to doing this research. And I think for us on this side of the table, our next real challenge is to figure out how to implement some of the ideas that we've heard so far. So I'll turn it over to Minnie for our next the entree and dessert.
I don't know about being entree and dessert. I'm sure Claire will at least add dessert, and it feels a little unfair to leave me with the entree. But I wanted to end the sequence by focusing a little bit more on what your role may be and what my role as an individual may be in this revolution that we see coming up. But just to back up for a second, I think you've got the sense for this, but to really confirm, this is really, really complicated. There are also pieces of this that we might in the software industry call vaporware. That is the sort of the miracle piece that Claire referred to that needs greater explanation. There's a huge set of steps here that we are not even sure what those steps are going to look like and what they're going to yield. However, the vision is very exciting, and that's why we're here, because we think that what we can get from the precision medicine revolution is large enough and exciting enough to be engaged. But in the mix, we have a big challenge, and which is we've been talking about using data, large sets of data. Dan's talked about some of our perceptions of what we might as individuals want to share. But the big need for precision medicine is going to be sharing data at scale, huge scale, huge scale. I don't think it's hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, it really has to be large scale to start getting the kinds of correlations that we're going to need. And in this, you're going to have a role, because if you don't have a role, we fear we may not be able to get access to the data in the way we need it. So the data necessary to enable the precision medicine vision is diverse. You've heard a bunch about it. It goes from DNA to, proteins and cells and organs and data that a physician gets in a hospital setting, and lots of environmental information as well, et cetera. They all have to come together to help us understand what's happening with a person at a particular point of time and make us more precise in dealing with those issues. But, as I said, we need lots of this data, not just diverse kinds of data. Who does hold this data? Let's just get down to it. So where is this data sitting, and why are we not pulling this data together? Well, healthcare systems hold the data. Hospitals hold your data when you go in and get services. Insurance companies hold a lot of interesting data about you, because they actually have a lot of your time course information, your life information, because you might go to many different places to get healthcare, and you can't stitch those together, but your insurance company probably can. Pharmacies hold your data. They can tell you about your prescription history. But in addition to healthcare providers, research organizations hold your data as well. Academic research holds your data. Drug companies hold your data when they do clinical trials and research on you. They've all got data about you and your health. But in addition to these, and Claire alluded to this, there are also participants in our life that you may not think are involved in healthcare that hold your data. All of the new consumer health devices hold your data. Fitbits hold your data that's relevant to your health. But in addition, there are also other aspects to your life. Your grocery store knows a lot about your eating behavior, your family's eating behavior, and your community's eating behavior. And by the way, I won't have time to go into this, but grocery stores know a lot about you and use that information to sell you things in different ways and thus influence your behavior. So a lot of different stakeholders own the kinds of data we're going to need to actually make this vision come to life. Now, are these holders of your data, are they getting together and saying, how do we put this together and start working on how we can actually create precision medicine? The answer is no. They are damming up all the information, of course. This is actually not a trivial point. I'm smiling and to set the stage, but it's a really big deal that our health relevant data are not owned, but certainly stored by very different kinds of stakeholders, none of whom are necessarily motivated to actually pool it together. Without pulling it together at scale, we are simply not going to be able to achieve this vision. To give you an example of vision that has been achieved at a small scale, so Kaiser has their division of research whom we collaborate with has done a wonderful job with about 120,000 records, where they've painstakingly over the years been able to get some genetic information and associated with some clinical information, and they've added some information from biobanking. It is top-notch. It is sort of what the best that we can do today. And it's simply not enough. And that's with a system that has access to a lot of records and is able to put it together. So we do need to break that down. So if not them, can you do anything about this? Well, there are two questions. One, are you able to? And two, do you want to? So Dan had spoken a little bit about what you may feel about what you want to do with your own data. We'll get there in a moment. But let's just first ask, are you even able to do anything about this? Is this in your control? What is your role? So we're going to talk about sort of two scenarios. One is when data is actually collected, what I might say, passively. So it's not that you go in and you say, hey, I want you to collect my data. You just go in to get services, and data is collected about you. So hospitals, Fitbit, et cetera, those are all great examples of places where you would use services, and people collect data on you. In some cases, like hospitals, you have the right to your own data. It's an explicit right, and some of you may or may not. How many of you know the term HIPAA? Great. Okay. Now, usually HIPAA is used in conversations about protecting your data. Here I'm going to talk to you about how HIPAA can be useful in thinking about how it can help us all free your data, which is a slight twist, because HIPAA embeds in it a right, your right to your own data. And the people that are covered are health plans, healthcare providers, health exchanges. So lots of those healthcare domain folks actually have to give you your data if you ask for it. And so this is just the actual terminology. You have the right to review and obtain a copy of your protected health information. Have any of you tried to do this? Was it easy? Right. Okay, so moving on. It was not easy? It was easy?
Yes, and no.
Aha. It was a snap. Did you get electronic records or paper records?
Well, I've gotten both.
Okay.
And you usually have to pay for it. It's called administrative charge.
They are allowed, actually, to charge, you know, some minimum sort of processing fee. It's bottom line, practically speaking, HIPAA may not get you what you want because bottom line, it's really, really hard to get your data. It's hard to obtain records. And one of the issues is that it's not necessarily always because people want to stop you from getting it, but electronic health records are simply just being rolled out right now. So this is just some data on where we are nationally on electronic health records. And the blue line tells you about adoption of at least a basic electronic health record. So that shows in 2012, 44% of these acute care hospitals had adoption of electronic health records. This line here that says 71 and then 85% in 2012 says 85% of hospitals have contracted in principle with a provider. So they will have electronic health records at some point. So that just tells you that even that most places don't even have electronic health records. So getting your information in a digital, actionable format is hard just because of those pragmatic issues. But as some of you have talked about, there are some people that are that have bleeding-edge technology that empowers individuals. Who do you think about when you think about bleeding-edge technology that empowers individuals? What was that?
Computers.
But which kinds of organizations? Hints? You wouldn't guess the government, but in fact, the VA, as was referenced by Claire, has been one of the earliest and most sophisticated providers of electronic health records in a format that's standardized and deployable and usable. So now there are others that are coming on the scene. Some insurance companies are doing it pretty well as well, standard, but the VA was way ahead of the game and are really blazing trailblazers in this regard. Kind of strange, not something that I would have predicted, but there you have it. Okay, so in some cases, you have the right to your data for those that fall under HIPAA. In other cases, you just simply don't. So any of the other examples I gave you, like non-traditional sources for data, like groceries, your gym records are actually relevant. None of those you have any right to. And then the new consumer health devices, it's very interesting. We don't know how much of that is going to actually be called personal health, protected health information. And so we're going to see how many of those are going to end up coming under some kind of HIPAA rule. But right now, you have no right to it. You can get, for example, Fitbit information. You can pay to get it, but they'll only give you average data for a day. They are not going to give you minute-by-minute data, anything that you might want to actually use. So there are lots of places where you're not going to be able to get data. Let's move on to places where you explicitly give someone control over your data. So these are when you participate in clinical research. When you participate in clinical research, you explicitly say, I am going to provide my data to somebody else so they can do research. Can you get your own data back? Very hard. There are some good reasons for holding back data, as Dan mentioned, which is sometimes the results are confusing and need interpretation and could be misleading. But mostly, and I don't think Dan would disagree with me, mostly it's because we do a really poor job of giving back data to you that's relevant. And we need to improve that. That's sort of in the trust arena, as Dan was mentioning. But then also, when you do consent, we do it poorly, and you usually do it just for one study. And just for one study, they put you through this much work. This is the beginning of a template for consent. This is just the template. So when you fill it in, it gets longer. And longer and longer. Again, just the template, and you're supposed to read all of this information and understand it. I don't know about you, but this came to me when I was pregnant. And I have to say, people came to me several times, and I might have signed up once, and it's only because I'm at UCSF, and I was like, okay, I know these people, I'm going to sign. But honestly, I didn't understand how anybody signed any of these consent forms and had any true understanding of what they were signing. It was pages and pages of information that was not easy to understand. This is a real problem because it feels like you're giving consent, but have you really understood what you're signing? I think most of us sign because we have a trusted relationship perhaps with the hospital or something like that. So that clearly needs to be improved. And after all that work, your data is used by one group. One study. And if you know anything about science, you know that usually lots and lots of studies have to happen before you get any meaningful information. All right, so are you able to free your own data? Really tough right now, but it's worth the effort, I think. But the other question was, do you want to share your data? Dan talked to us a little bit about some of the perceptions related to that. I just want to throw a few framing thoughts. This is a very complicated arena, and you're going to have your personal opinions about it. I just wanted to throw a bunch of different pieces of information that may stimulate your thinking. So the first that, again, has been referred to by Claire and Dan is, this is already happening without your permission. This is not just a single company. This is not Google has your data and Facebook has your data. This is that people are stitching together data from multiple sources, scraping information, and constructing your entire life history. It's happening today. This is just the way it is. And it's just something we have to accept, unfortunately. There is a Time magazine article that I could find that I ran into that actually where the author goes to many private providers of information about himself, and he finds different tales, some of them that have some truths to them, but a lot of them that don't, that these people are able to put together, and companies can go out and buy that information and say, you know, this is our perception of Terry's life. This is where she went to school. This is where she lives. This is her husband. These are her likes, her dislikes, etc. And so this is happening today, and that's just the reality. So then what about public perceptions? We've been hearing a little bit about perceptions around biobank repositories. Here's just one other example. There was a big survey that was done in 2007. Again, the answers pretty much were mixed. So the public were 50-50 about providing their data, even if it was anonymized, to health researchers. So that suggests a great deal of skepticism. Certainly some people are ready to do it, but a great deal of skepticism by the public. And this supports what Dan is finding out now as well. The other thing to keep in mind that I found interesting is that especially around privacy, when you ask people about their attitudes towards privacy, there's evidence to suggest that may differ from how they actually end up behaving. There's a gap between their attitude toward privacy when they talk about it versus what you end up feeling like, what the trade-offs are when you actually get down to it. So that's going to influence probably where you and I land in the spectrum of things. A last piece, which I'm just going to leave you with as a little highlight, because it's fascinating, and that's a topic of another entirely different talk, and there's some great articles. I should probably try to put these together maybe as a reading list after this. There's a super article in The New Yorker as well about this. But there are lots of opinions around privacy, and we're in a changing time around what it means to have data about yourself, be it health or otherwise, and what the implications are. And they're both positive and negative. And there are people that will say that privacy is absolutely essential, is a bedrock of democracy. And there's a very different perception that, in fact, there is a public good to be had, and you have to free your data to achieve that public good. In a very simplistic example, I've been using a whole bunch of figures here that are all Creative Commons figures, images from Flickr. These are all images that, 10 years ago I would never have been able to use. I'm able to use them because the domain of sharing people's creativity has changed, because people thought, yes, I would like to share my figures, I'd like a few little rights, but I'd actually like you to use it. So if you notice, there was a picture of someone's kid playing with Lego bricks, and I used that to illustrate, can you actually do something, and can you get your data? And that's somebody's kid, but they were comfortable with sharing it, and I'm delighted because he's very cute, this little baby, and I've managed to share him with you to illustrate a point. Very simplistic example, but that's an example of a public good because people decided to share their data. So it's a complicated debate, fascinating debate. Go and read about it, and it requires debate, though, for sure. So I want to end with how some people are experimenting using some of these new ideas around privacy and understanding that there are certain limits right now to what we can do with the data that exists. And so there are two kinds of ideas that I want to share with you. One is something called open consent. By the way, both these are very, very new. They're not proven. They're just pushing at the boundaries. So what open consent says is that, look, consenting is hard, and it needs to be hard because it's some tricky stuff, and you need to think deeply about what you're consenting to. But do it once. Do it really thoroughly, not the pages that I showed you, which I couldn't read and wouldn't read, but do it thoroughly, and then give it away forever. Done. It's not really forever. You can return to it. You have control over it. But the point is, you don't just give it away to one study. Invest a little time and then give it in a way where many studies can benefit. So at least your investment has some fruit at the end of that. So this is just some pictures to show you what that consent looks like. It begins by saying it's a complicated process. It really makes sure that you understand what's going to happen with your research. These are sort of the rights that you're granting. It's very clear about it. And in the end, they make you watch, this is one example, this could evolve, they make you watch a 7-minute video. And I tried to skip it because I wanted screenshots in the middle of the video, and it was really hard. I had to go through the whole 7 minutes, and I didn't. So they don't allow you to skip it at all. And at the end of it, you go through other kinds of checkpoints to make sure you understand exactly what's happening here with your data. And then they give you ways in which you can always go back and change your mind, which is actually really important as well. So this is an example where you put a lot of effort up front, but then after that, you give permission to any researcher that's appropriately qualified to use the data. Very different model than you signing that consent form, and it's used for one study. For the next study, you'd have to do the same consent form with little differences, so you'd have to read again. So this is one model. Another model is to say, well, instead of saying, here's everything and go for it, let's see what happens if we allow folks to share data when they want to share data and have much more granular permissions about sharing the data. So it's not just, here's my data, use it. I decide that I want to share my genetic information only with my physician. I can provide you data about, this is an example of the system actually here, that the Genetic Alliance, it's a big disease advocacy agency. It's led by a mom of two kids that had a rare disease, really, really well known. So they're experimenting with this. And so you could provide a lot of your own data. This is actually some data that I started providing about myself. This just shows how many more questions I could do if I want to. They actually make it really fun, which is a new approach to it. So instead of feeling really dreary, it sort of gamifies providing your data because you immediately see what you look like relative to others. So I kept doing more questions because I was curious about where I stood. Anyway, and so you can provide a lot of information, and this just shows you what some of the data ends up looking like. I'm a morning person, how much sleep I get. And then when you go in to do your permissions, you have lots of granularity about your permissions. And you can decide, you know, whether you want to give, share your data with advocacy and support groups and medical researchers. And, you know, maybe you can allow them to discover your data, but you don't want them to really to contact you. So they can see your data if it's anonymous, but not contact you. In some cases, you might want them to contact you, et cetera. Now, with granular permissions comes complexity. So as you know, Facebook, which has been talked about a lot today, has lots of granular permissions. But I don't know about you, I don't like going into the permission setting and reading all those lines of text and figuring out what do I agree with and what do I not agree with. And so the people that put this together, they actually represent participants. They're not scientists. They work very closely with scientists. And they realize this could be a barrier. So the other innovation is to use the concept of a guide. So these are examples of guides, and actually this is my friend and colleague Sharon Terry, who runs the Genetic Alliance, and she is the mom of two kids with PIXI, which is a rare genetic disorder. And so you can actually hear from her, as a mom of someone with rare diseases, what approach she takes to sharing data. You can then decide whether you like her philosophy or not. If you like her philosophy, you can wholesale take over her permissions, and then you can change little bits, but at least it gives you a starting point. Or maybe you choose Robert, who has a daughter with some other situation that matches your family situation. So this provides a way of having people that you trust help guide you through perhaps what permissions make sense or not. So this is another example that people are experimenting with, to saying maybe this can allow folks to share more of their data because they feel like they have more control over what they allow to be shared or not. It's not some black box. It's in your hands. So it's not clear which of these is actually going to have traction or there's going to be a new approach, but it shows you that people are pushing boundaries. So I wanted to just end with a summary. So what I've shared with you is that we really do need to collect diverse data to achieve, and diverse and large-scale data to achieve the vision of precision medicine. Today, this data is hard to compile. It's really hard to share. And I haven't even touched upon, once you share it, how hard it is to make sense of it. That's sort of the next piece of it. But if we can't put it together, we can't even test where are the real difficulties, where is it easier, et cetera. And there are some recent efforts that are trying to reinvent the approach to freeing your data. I'm not sure all of them will work, but we need more experiments like that that really push the boundaries of how we feel about our data, what we want to share, what we want to close off to, and how we incorporate the emerging reality that today there is a lot of data about ourselves that we have no control over. So within that context, how do we want to position ourselves? Do we stick our heads in the sand? Do we embrace it and go forward? I guess you can tell from my comments which way I lean, but this is your decision in the end. Thanks.
So now you've had two fantastic speakers giving you a sense about data and trust, and we have some time now for open dialogue. I'd be happy to moderate this part of it, and I will repeat your question because we are taping, and this presentation will be on UCTV in the future. So are there some burning questions that that you'd like to start with?
Status.
So the question is about the shift into the use or the availability of the cloud and how that will affect our employees at UCSF. But I'm not many, maybe, and Dan, maybe you'd like to come over here too.
So there are a couple of things bundled in there, and so it's a great point. I think basically you're pointing out that the way in which we're going to do business with technology is changing dramatically. And there's at least two pieces. You talked about UCSF employees, and I think some part of that is just us realizing, this is probably not related to precision medicine, but just us realizing what we should be doing at UCSF and what we should be leaving to the people that do it best. And we're really taking that to heart. I think the other piece, though, is relevant to how we're training physicians for the future. And this is a topic that, you know, so our Vice Dean of Education in the School of Medicine, Catherine Lucy, is passionate about. She knows that the people that we're training today are going to be physicians 10 years down the line, not just tomorrow. We're pretty late for tomorrow, but certainly for the future. So in that case, we know that a physician is probably not going to be the same as what we see today. And in fact, you are right. There's going to be lots of roles that we haven't even constructed today, because the roles are going to be about dealing with the outcomes, the outputs of precision medicine. So when precision medicine is successful, you're going to have all this data, and you're going to need people that are really savvy at dealing with the data. Not, you don't need the MD to do that, or you train the MD a little better. This is a debate about, do you train the MD differently? Do you train additional people? And so the care the care environment now includes an MD, but also a couple of data analysts and so on and so forth. But this is a topic of active conversation in our training programs as we get our physicians ready for the next, you know, many years. Great question.
So it's an interesting question. So outcome, what would outcome be here? So part of what Dan studies, and I can let him speak to this, is in fact how people feel about using these new kinds of tools, also consenting, using new devices, et cetera. Beyond that, outcomes in terms of balancing sort of how people feel and impact on research, it's too early to tell what's going to happen by using these new tools that rethink consent. Most of them are actually more detailed. They allow you to, in fact, for folks like yourself, to actually spend the time to really understand what you're doing, but do it in a way where you feel like you're not going to do it over and over and over and over again. So it's not about actually reducing. Neither of these, the new approaches I showed you, was about reducing the effort you put in to understanding what's happening. In fact, the open consent is specifically forces you to do more. The difference is they say do more, fully understand, but then open it up to many people. So at least that investment has a higher sort of return. There's no there's no question, because these are just beginning. So absolutely. So right now, both the efforts I shared with you are very preliminary. You have, you know, early adopters really choosing those. I myself have lots of conflicted thoughts about sharing my information. I have to come to grips with the fact that my data is already known. So I'm quite honest about it myself. So that's why it's a personal struggle, people. You're right about the Facebook thing. This is what I was saying. People's attitudes are different from what they end up, the behavior they end up showing. And they actually end up doing a lot riskier things, which is not necessarily good, but they do, much riskier than what, if you ask them, they would do.
Do you want to speak about the attitudes?
Very briefly on the consenting, I think part of the challenge is we don't really know what works. We actually are not even sure how to define what works is. So does a consent form work if people understand what the research project is, or if they understand that they're giving their data away? Does it work if more people sign up for the study? Does it work if fewer people sign up for the study? And the second step of Engage UC is actually doing is innovation in that space. So to do the empirical research, including some randomized trials of different consenting mechanisms. And strangely enough, no one has really done that before. So.
And given that we live in California, you know, it's not just even one language. It'll be multiple languages, multiple levels of literacy, ways of presenting a consent form and through a wide variety of mechanisms beyond just reading, you know, traditionally long consent forms. How about the gentleman in the back on the right?
As you described bio. Yeah. So try to capture the question for the microphone is a recognition that there's actually analogous types of research that have occurred in non-human contexts around agriculture, where biobanks have been used and seeds produced, but that's led to some really difficult problems as those that research and that information has been monetized, and that's really restricted how this useful information can get out. And what about in precision medicine? Is that same trend likely to appear? And I think there are two answers. And the first answer is we don't know and we're worried about it. So in addition to the Engage UC project, one of the things that I'm working on and that Claire is also involved with is a work group to think about exactly these issues. What are the types of regulatory structures that are out there that apply to precision medicine, and how do we interact with them as we develop these various components of the precision medicine platform? So that's one answer, is we don't know yet, but we're working on it. We just literally met this week for the first time. And on that work group, we have lawyers in intellectual property law, in contracting and privacy law, bioethicists, and then people who are working on compliance, and then people who understand the technical aspects of precision medicine and the types of research resources that we're bringing to bear. So we hope we have the right people around the table to begin the conversation. I think the second answer is going back to this, the genetic privacy bill. I think lawmakers are very concerned about this, and I think that there is a difference between Facebook and healthcare. that lawmakers are aware of and policymakers are aware of. And my hope is that we will not sort of extinguish the good stuff that can come from this research by using a blunt tool like a law that just prohibits this kind of research, but we come up with sort of evidence-based policies that help us regulate it properly so we don't have that situation with our own bodies. But it's a huge concern. It's something our deliberants raised again and again and again. They're worried about cloning. They're worried about biobanks being used in military research, and they're very worried about the potential of abuse by individuals who don't follow the rules. So that was another theme that came up in our discussions, and so it's something we're thinking a lot about, but I don't have an answer yet.
Sure. So this is it's a really good point, and there are some immediate cases that you can think about where freed sort of health data are actually probably not that used in a non-attractive way. So some of the examples people give are sort of how it contributes to this nanny state notion. So it can sound really, really good. So if there's sufficient data, you can get little nudges about your eating behavior at the right moment, and maybe the government or maybe some company is doing it, and it seems like a really positive thing. Why not use the data to show you, this is the fifth time that you've bought a steak, and maybe now you should buy something else because it's better for your health. So that's really positive. On the other hand, it ends up creating the sense of a world where you have a little less control, actually, about who's making decisions about what's good for you and what's not. So very tricky situation and certainly possible. I would argue that the issue perhaps is less about collecting the data, but more about the commons, or whether we're even thinking about a commons, or if we're thinking about an open approach to the data. And this is true for agriculture, which I know less about, but I know a little bit through my partner. When we're commons and thinking about commoning and different ways of valuing maybe a way out. So it's because sometimes the biobank in agriculture, for example, is actually very helpful because it's a way of keeping lost traditions and lost sources of seeds. Other times it's abused, and it's a way of protecting and making sure only some people have access to the intellectual property and others don't. So it's going to be about how we manage that information, I'm hoping, and less about whether we collect the information or not. But you're absolutely right, we should be looking there for lessons and learning from it when we talk about health data.
Sort of one question is about whether people have different feelings about releasing their data if it's anonymized or de-identified versus if it's identifiable, and do people, are the sensitivities different, and then generational questions. And to the first question, I can say, I know at one point I knew if there was an answer to that, and I'd looked at the literature and I cannot remember what it says, so I will, Minnie may know and she'll bail me out, but if not, I'll try to regurgitate that and get it to Terry or someone to bring it back to a future session. I know some research has been done on it, but I just can't recall what the results are. The generational issue is a very interesting issue, and we purposefully for our San Francisco event recruited young folks to try to get a sense about how they would react to these different ideas around biobanking. And I can't say that we heard anything. They definitely thought about it differently. Whether that made a difference in terms of, you know, their areas of agreement and disagreement seemed much less clear. And what I'm very curious about as we dig further into what we did is we recorded everything that was said throughout the whole weekend. So we have hundreds and hundreds of sort of tapes, hours to look at and listen to and figure out what people thought. I am curious to whether we're going to find anything in that. And it may be that there is a different way of talking about it, but I'm not sure we heard that there was a fundamental different relationship to privacy and data. So that's a great question. Hopefully we'll know some more in a couple months once we can dig into our data more.
I might just add, sorry, just on the anonymized data piece. So the data that I showed from the survey done in 2007, the IOM-sponsored survey, they don't differentiate between anonymized and de-anonymized and sort of named data. But I was really surprised that even for anonymized data, the result was that 50%, only 50% said that they were okay with anonymized data going for health research. I was really, really surprised by that because that feels like the low barrier. The other thing I will say that it's important to keep in mind is, InterTrust came to us. It's a big security company, and they're looking at moving into the area of helping us understand how to protect genetic privacy. But the reason they're doing it, I don't know if they're just one of many people. The reason they're doing it is because even when you think your genetic information is anonymous, it can be retraced through the variety of information we know about people. This is what's tricky. This is where I say, I don't know how much of it we just have to say, this is going to happen, and then learn to manage it or try to protect it. It's going to be some combination of the two. But when you see that there's the profit-seeking motive has seen an opportunity and is working on it, you know that, in fact, there is a business to be made from reconstructing information from supposedly anonymous information. So that tells you something needs to be fixed.
And I was going to say that I think the generational issue is, I see a major pendulum also, because, for example, in some recent research that I've been involved in Central Valley, California, there were a number of young people who said, I can't go to that family planning clinic because somebody might take a picture of me and put it up on a Facebook, and it'll really stigmatize me for going and seeking care. So there, and also we've seen the issues of cyberbullying. So there may be a pendulum that will swing even with your nieces and nephews, but we're in uncharted territory, and I think that that's part of the challenge.
So in fact, one of the models people use to deal with the privacy issue is to say that one way to deal with the privacy challenges is to monetize. So in other words, these are all different models because this is new. So they say, well, maybe you have more control over by creating a system where when any piece of your data is used by anybody, it is given a monetary value and you get that benefit. I think that's restrictive as well. But
either direction,
exactly. But that's actually one of the, hand waving. This is all sort of coming in the future kinds of conversations, but that is actually one of the models people look at to when they're talking about what kinds of, how we should deal with this whole privacy issue.
So this is I have like a list of all the things that happened in these deliberations that surprised me. And one of them was I thought we actually, people talked quite a bit about whether they felt that donors should be paid for their samples. Under different scenarios, if it's pure research, if it's sponsored research, if it leads to a new drug. And the answer, not unanimously, but pretty much consistently, was no. There was a very old school, people should participate in research because of the public benefit and because they want to help future generations, not because they should get money back. And when we said, well, what about Henrietta Lacks, whose samples have proven, have been the foundation for a gazillion dollars of research and drug discovery around the world, and her family is still impoverished, and that didn't really move people's opinions on this, and I found that very surprising. So I think it's another issue which is hard to say where it's going to go, but we definitely heard this notion of there's still a sort of pure motive for donation that should be preserved and respected.
And will it be available to the patients themselves? You're saying. And I would say that there's a great agreement here
but more important, I just want to, the what you really want, and this is why the VA model that they kicked off is so exciting. You really want the data to come out in a way where you get a little file and you can put it somewhere where it fits in nicely with your file. Let's say you went for some specialty care to UCSF. You want your Kaiser record to plug in nicely to the record that you get from UCSF, to perhaps some prescription records from Walgreens. And all of that then tells you the full story of your health history. That's what you want. And that's what's exciting about what the VA has been a leader in, is not just that you can get the data, but that you get it in this format that's a standard that can help this sort of plug and play so we can actually construct the entire record. So that's the vision. We will get there. I don't know when, but we will get there.
So I want to thank Minnie and Dan for a wonderful panel tonight and for all of you for attending. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.